Stadium of the United Nations. Captain Otto Joseph M. Barry Bryan, he needs to be talent. Letter of Earl Rose, Arnold Johan Conrad Jr., Philadelphia Patrick Daniel at Bass Knight, three colors.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Kevin Otto. I represent Kings Mill Community Services Association. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The association is a Virginia nonstop corporation. It is the Property Owners Association for Kings Mill Development in Williamsburg. There are approximately 2,400 homes in that development. The articles of incorporation of the association contain provisions governing the election of its board of directors, including provisions such as how many directors are to be elected, can cumulative voting be used, can votes be split. There is an actual live controversy between the association and some of its members on those very points. For example, should three directors be elected or four? Is cumulative voting permitted? Can votes be split among candidates? These controversies were raised by the defendants in the form of threats against the corporation and its current board, stating that if the election were held according to the rules that the association believed applied, there would be litigation. As a result of that, the association filed a declaratory judgment action in the Circuit Court at Williamsburg, asking that its articles of incorporation be construed and that the court declare the voting rights attendant to the election. The defendants filed a demur, saying there is no controversy, it's all a matter of speculation, and the circuit court agreed and dismissed the case, which was error. Compounding that error, the court dismissed the case with prejudice, would not allow leave to amend, and of course what we have here is a dismissal for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, so you can't dismiss on that ground with prejudice. The merits of the case have never been reached. This is a classic case for the application of the declaratory judgment statute. The statute makes clear that the interpretation of a written document is a proper subject of a declaratory judgment action.
Counsel, may I interrupt you with this question? You mentioned, I think, a moment ago that the dismissal was implicating subject matter jurisdiction, and therefore, as a matter of logic as well as law, it can't be with prejudice. But is that necessarily true? I mean, you can have a deck action where there is no subject matter jurisdiction because prematurity or some ripeness problem is so grave that no court could hear it. But the declaratory judgment action generally is still a statutorily discretionary remedy. So isn't it altogether possible to have subject matter jurisdiction, but the trial judge say, you know, there's so many moving parts here, I want this to play out in the real world before I actually bring it into court, and issue a discretionary but nonetheless jurisdictionally adequate dismissal?
Well, I suppose that's theoretically possible, but what the court did here was say, I don't have subject matter jurisdiction because there is no actual controversy, therefore I cannot consider the matter under the statute because the statute requires an actual controversy. So, because the facts, according to the trial court, the facts alleged weren't sufficient to show the actual controversy. Where what happened was, after the court made that ruling, counsel for the association said, is there leave to amend? And the court said, well, I could give you leave to amend, but that's not going to change my mind.
I guess what I'm asking is your worry that if we were to affirm this and you have a dismissal with prejudice, you could not bring me an action later?
That's how we interpret the ruling of the court, that the matter is dismissed with prejudice.
Well, if it's not accrued now, you can't have prejudicial dismissal of an unaccrued claim.
I would agree, but we have the order that says it's dismissed with prejudice, so I think if we went back tomorrow and sit to the circuit court, the first thing we'd get is that each out of this order is that entry that says the case has been dismissed with prejudice. I agree with your point, that was improper. So this is just the classic case for the application of the statute. We ask the court to construe the articles. There is an actual controversy. The allegations in the complaint are numerous, showing the controversy, showing the threats that were made of litigation should the election proceed in the manner that the corporation intended it to proceed. Remarkably, the defendants didn't join in. One would think that having created a controversy in the first place by saying, if you do it this way, we're going to sue you, when the association said, we'd like a declaratory judgment, you would think that the defendants would have said, me too. Please, court, declare the rights of the parties. Tell us if there are three directors or four to be elected, and so on. The circuit court, though, bought the argument that this was a matter of speculation. And the court did that because it said, there's no guarantee that if we have the election that the defendants are ever going to sue. So it's pure speculation. Well, that's not the standard. That's not the test for a declaratory judgment action. There's nothing in the statute, there's nothing in this case, this court's cases, that say that in order for a declaratory judgment to lie, there has to be absolute certainty that a subsequent lawsuit will be filed. And for good reason. No one knows. There's no guarantee that there will be a lawsuit filed in any declaratory judgment setting should declaratory relief not be granted. The test is actual controversy over the legal rights of the parties, and that was met here. The circuit court had a second ground for finding that it lacked subject matter jurisdiction. It referred to the Non-Stop Corporation Act, Section 13.1-861 of the Code, which provides a statutory post-election challenge to a board election. And the court said, that's your remedy. That's the only remedy. You can't do it on the front end. You have to have the election, and then there has to be a suit on the back end. And again, that was an incorrect result. The statute, first of all, can't be exclusive because it did not create the remedy in the first place. At common law, there were actions, for example, with the writ of quo warranto and declaratory judgments as well, that allowed for challenges to the seating of the board of directors. In fact, this court has granted a declaratory judgment in the Stewart versus Lady case while the statute was on the books. So clearly that statute's not the exclusive remedy. In Stewart versus Lady, there was a challenge to the composition of a nonstop board, and that was done by declaratory judgment. And this court issued a declaratory judgment stating who the directors were. So the argument that there was this statutory remedy, again, there is that statutory remedy, but that is only after the fact. It doesn't create any rights, doesn't allow for any rights to be pursued prior to the election. And there was good reason for the corporation to do this. It's the corporation's articles, for one thing. It's the corporation's board that's going to be elected. The board manages the affairs of the corporation. So the outcome of this controversy was going to directly affect the association. We cited several cases, the declaratory judgment cases from other jurisdictions, as well as the Stewart versus Lady case from this court, where declaratory relief was allowed in the context of a dispute over the election of a corporate board. And again, this was a very simple case. What do the articles say? Do they allow three directors to be elected or four? Do they allow cumulative voting or not? Do they allow vote splitting or not? The association asked that be decided on the front end rather than hazard the liability of getting sued on the back end for not conducting the election properly and having the controversy that would result not only after the election was held, when there would be this period while the litigation was pending over the challenge to the directors, where the identity of the directors would be unknown, which would come attendant to that would be uncertainty over who the board was and how the affairs of the corporation were to be managed. But also the controversy that would be attendant at the meeting itself. The meeting of the members is where the election takes place. And so the corporation wished to avoid that sort of tumultuous meeting, that sort of acrimonious meeting that was going to unfold. This is a very strongly disputed matter, and the association believed it was in the best interest of the association and its members that the matter be adjudicated at the front end rather than at the back end.
Counsel, as I understand declaratory judgment, it's to adjudicate rights and not decide issues.
Correct.
There's a fine line, and it's sometimes difficult to draw. The courts don't want to issue advisory opinions. What rights of your client are you seeking to adjudicate in this declaratory judgment action?
You're exactly right, and I think there are several. First of all, the declaratory judgment seeks the construction of the corporation's articles. So it's the corporation's articles that are to be construed. It's the corporation's board that is going to be elected. So the outcome of this controversy directly affects the corporation and the management of its affairs, because the outcome of the controversy determines who's going to be on the board, which determines how the affairs of the association are going to be managed. I also think it's clearly seen when you look at it from the back end, the action under the statute after the election under 13.1861. Let's assume that that action is filed. Who has to be a defendant in that case? The corporation absolutely is a necessary party to that case. You couldn't have a suit challenging the election of the board, seeking to upset the election, change the composition of the board, without the corporation being a party. So I think when you see it from that perspective, it clearly shows the corporation's rights and interests in this matter. And so the corporation was a proper party to bring the action. Again, compounding this, you have the denial of leave to amend, where the circuit court, instead of applying the factors that are well known, such as prejudice to the defendants, where are we in the stage of the case, has there been leave to amend granted before, the circuit court just said, I could give you leave, but it's not going to change my mind, so no. Well, again, that's not the standard. That's not a factor. The circuit court should have looked at the fact that there had never been an amendment, that this was at the beginning of the case, and that there was no prejudice to the defendants should an amendment be allowed. And this was an important issue. If you assume, which we don't, but if you assume that the original complaint didn't adequately allege facts showing an actual controversy, the amended complaint would have shown, for example, that after the demurrer was granted, one of the defendants began the process of filing an administrative action saying the corporation is violating its articles by electing 4 directors instead of 3. That's the very claim in count 1 of the complaint. So there's nothing speculative about that. One of the defendants was actually bringing that on. Similarly, with regard to count 3, which sought a declaration as to vote splitting, one of the defendants, after the governor was granted, sent in a voting rights agreement to the corporation saying, my wife and I are going to split our votes. Well, how can that be speculative? It was put right in front of the corporation. So those facts could have been alleged.
Were those facts proffered to the trial court?
They were not proffered. The oral motion was made for leave to amend, which was denied. Those facts didn't exist at that time. Subsequent to the entry of the order before the 21 days ran, those facts became known. We filed a motion for reconsideration and put that in the record. It is in the record, and asked the court for relief, vacating the order and allowing an amended pleading to be filed in the court. The circuit court did not rule on the motion for reconsideration.
You had wanted to reserve 3 minutes. You're down to 2 minutes and 36 seconds.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Johan Conrad. I represent 3 of the appellees in this case: Kingsmill United, Inc., John Nyland, and Michael McGurk. One of our fellow appellees who's proceeding pro se is also here today. His name is Leonard Burrell. He's in the audience, right over here. Mr. Burrell has graciously agreed to allow me to take all of the 15 minutes allotted to the appellees this morning. In August of 2014, KCSA indefinitely suspended the election that was scheduled to be held in September of 2014 for the board of directors slots. 15 months later, we stand here today, and that election still has not occurred. Now, of course, this court for years...
Part of the reason for that is your client so actively contested the DEC action. That could have gone forward and been decided in a couple of months, and you would have had this entire dispute taken care of.
Your Honor, there was a demurrer and a motion to dismiss filed, a brief, and there was a short hearing before the trial court. The trial court agreed that this was not a proper matter for declaratory judgment. The trial court agreed that the Nonstop Corporation Act section 13.1-861 would be the appropriate remedy if one were in fact needed. And in fact, Your Honor...
But that's a post-election remedy.
It is a post-election remedy.
The point of the deck action is to file something that gives you a right of a judicial determination before your cause of action is fully ripened.
I understand that, Your Honor, but let's break it down into a couple pieces. Number one, when they filed the complaint, among my clients is Kingsmill United, Inc., which does not even have an ability to vote in this election. So one of my clients was not even a proper party to this action to begin with. The other issue is that
was
they
that
didn't...
the basis of the trial court's ruling?
It was not, Your Honor. But you just asked me about our contest of this action, so I'm trying to bring out some reasons why that happened. In addition, they, with respect to the parties, they didn't name all of the candidates for the board of directors election. They named a few of the members, but not nearly all. There's lots and lots of members of this particular association, and so there were good reasons for my clients to contest this particular action. Your Honor, I'll make a quick point about 13.1.861 because you talk about the fact that it's a post-election remedy. You're right that it's a post-election remedy. And I think if you look at the way that the General Assembly constructed that provision, and in fact, as I understand it from some of the case law that's been cited here, there's similar statutes around the country and other states. The General Assembly specifically chose in that statutory framework to provide an avenue for members and directors who were aggrieved to file an application to the circuit court with respect to the board of director election. But they specifically chose not to make the corporation one of the aggrieved persons who would be able to file under that particular statutory framework. And I think that that speaks volumes about whether or not the corporation itself that filed this lawsuit has any quote-unquote rights to be adjudicated here. Though, as we know, the declaratory judgment statute requires that, as Justice just asked, requires that there be actual rights to be adjudicated and not disputed issues. When determining who would have potential rights to be adjudicated, the General Assembly has already answered that question. They said in 13.1.861, there may be members and there may be directors who are aggrieved. And they need to file an application if they don't like the way that the election went down. And they can name the corporation as a defendant. The General Assembly is aware that the corporation may have an interest. But the General Assembly specifically chose not to recognize the corporation as a person or entity having a right to bring such an action. And I think that speaks volumes about the rights that are at issue here. And so I'm getting a little far afield from the question that kicked me off here. But I wanted to make that point that here... there's a reason that the framework is the way that it is. I want to present my argument today in three basic phases, and I've already gone a little bit into phase one, but the first one I'll talk a little bit about declaratory judgment actions generally and the interplay of declaratory judgment actions and statutory proceedings. Secondly, I'll talk a little bit more about some of the defects in the actual complaint filed here. Again, I've talked about it a little bit already. And then third, I'll get to the issue of whether or not there should have been amendment permitted in the case. For years, this court has drawn careful boundaries around the declaratory judgment statute and declaratory judgment actions to keep them from flooding the civil litigation landscape. There are several different, and actual controversy is simply what you need to get in the door. That's not the end of the analysis. In fact, it's the beginning of the analysis. So you can't, a declaratory judgment action must be intended to supplement rather than supersede ordinary causes of action. It can't be used when another mode of proceeding is available. It must be used, as we just discussed, to address actual rights and not issues. And it can't be used as a method of what courts call procedural fencing. All of those things happened here in the wrong way. In effect, what the corporation did here by filing this action was it took the summary proceeding that the General Assembly has specifically set forth in the Non-Stock Corporation Act and said, essentially, we are not going to proceed, or we're not going to allow any disputes regarding this election to proceed in that fashion because we want to set them all up in the way that we want to set them up in this declaratory judgment proceeding. And I want to read quickly one very short line from a case that was actually cited in the corporation's reply brief. It was a decision by this court in 1923 called Pierce Oil Corporation v. John Ferran. In that case, the court was addressing the sister statute, the one that applies to stock corporations versus non-stock corporations, but in all other respects is materially identical. And the court, in discussing that statute, said, such a statute is proven to be one of the wisest and best that a legislature ever enacted in regard to corporations. It furnishes a speedy, simple, just, and effective remedy for all complaints and is free from useless technicalities and expense. That's the statute that by filing this declaratory judgment action, the corporation essentially superseded. That's the statute, the one that this court has called one of the wisest and best that a legislator ever came up with to deal with corporate disputes. That was the other mode of proceeding that would have been available if this particular election had been permitted to go forward. But instead, the corporation usurped essentially the issues that would have been there. And they said, okay, these are all the issues that we think will come up if we proceed in the fashion that we plan to proceed. If we conduct the election in the fashion that we plan to conduct it right now, we think that somebody's going to file an action under this statute that is speedy, simple, just, and effective, free from useless technicalities and expense. And instead of proceeding in that fashion, we want to proceed via this declaratory judgment action. And that's what the trial court properly said is not proper. You can't do it that way. And so, Your Honor, we think that the trial court reached the right result with respect to that issue.
May I ask you this? If that logic were true, would it also be true that whenever there's a statutory cause of action, a Lanham Act case, any sort of civil conspiracy, 18.2499 case, whenever there's a statutory cause of action, post-accrual, would that logically mean there can never be a DEC action pre-accrual?
Number one, I think that there you've hit on a point that draws the distinction between when you're talking about rights versus issues. And I think that there are, and this court has recognized, some situations where if there was the scenario that you're talking about, where there's a future risk of damages. For example, there was the case that this court addressed that involved attorneys who didn't want to deal with the title company because they didn't think the title company was appropriately licensed to practice law. And they were worried about the title company suing them for antitrust violations and for the attorney's continuing refusal to deal with the title company to enhance the ongoing damages. And so the attorneys came to this court, or actually they came to the trial court, and the trial court wouldn't let them do what they wanted to do. So they came to this court and they said, look, if we don't file this DEC action, and instead we just continue to act in the way that we're acting, we continue not to deal with this title company, the damages that we face in a potential antitrust action down the road are going to continue to mount. And that sort of potential future liability is the kind of thing that we want to address with this declaratory judgment action. And this court said that is appropriate. So if there are, I think that there are some future potential sources of liability that could give rise to, or that could be sufficient such that you could file a declaratory judgment action pre-accrual. In other words, same thing happened in the Hop-In Foods case. In the Hop-In Foods case, there was a person who owned some property, was leasing to one person called Servin, and they said, and Hop-In Foods terminated their lease with the Servin people and signed a new lease with this other guy named Davis. Well, Davis, Servin then told Davis, you're trespassing because Hop-In shouldn't have terminated the lease with us and done a new lease with you. So then Davis was sitting here thinking, okay, if I continue to do what I'm doing, Servin has said that they're going to sue me for trespass, they're going to do all these kinds of things, and as long as I sit here on this property continuing to operate my business, those damages are going to continue to increase and my exposure is going to continue to grow. And this court said a declaratory judgment in that circumstance is appropriate because you're asking for a declaration with respect to your rights. What are you allowed to do with this property? And by giving that declaration, the court is therefore providing some certainty with respect to your liability for future damages. But as Justice said a few minutes ago, it's hard sometimes to figure out where the line is between rights versus issues. But if you look at what appears to be the line between when you're talking about adjudicating rights, which is okay under the declaratory judgment statute, or deciding contested issues, which is not appropriate under the declaratory judgment statute, the courts appear to be saying, okay, if you have a future, if the damages that may be brought against you are continuing to grow and your liability is continuing to increase, you can bring a declaratory judgment action to find out or to state what you can do and what you can't do so that you can avoid having some million-dollar judgment against you down the road. Same thing with insurance companies. Insurance companies come in and they want a declaratory judgment action because they're worried about bad faith. And a lot of times, if you read the cases that involve declaratory judgment actions in the context of an insurance company, what happens is there's a demand made by the plaintiff to the insured party, and it's above the policy limits. And the insurance company wants to deny, but then they're worried about the fact that the insured may be exposed to exposure outside the policy limits. So the insurance company comes in and says, we need some clarity. We need some relief because we may be on the hook for bad faith if we act in the way that we want to act. So in all those situations, you're talking about some future liability, some future damages that are occurring.
In those cases, is there any evidence that the trial court required for proof of the justiciable controversy that the defendant was going to pursue legal recourse against the plaintiff? I mean, that seems to be what happened in this case, is that they said the plaintiff hasn't proven the elements of the declaratory judgment action because they haven't proven that you would pursue legal recourse. So in the cases that you're talking about, was that required?
In a number of them, Your Honor, I think the answer is yes, but I want to be a little bit careful because I don't think that in all cases the trial court expressly acknowledged that. But for example, in the attorney's case, my recollection is that an antitrust case had actually been filed in federal court. In the Hopin case, there were actually a couple of companion cases. One, I think, had been filed in Roanoke and another in another jurisdiction. But in any event, there was clearly going to be litigation. In the insurance cases, usually in the insurance cases, there is pending litigation. For example, if there's a car accident, there's pending litigation over that personal injury claim, and the deck action grows out of that and deals with the situation in that context. So you think
that is a proper requirement?
I do. And I do think that you've put your finger on an important point here, which is that there really was no assurance that any action would have been filed. I mean, think about it this way. It's almost, I don't want to get too far afield here, but an example I've been familiar with, Bush v. Gore. Okay, there were some issues with some ballots down in Florida. But the reason that those issues mattered is because the election came down to just a few ballots. There would have never been any litigation if one side or the other had won by 3 million votes. The reason we had all that litigation is because you actually had to figure out who won. If we had gone forward with this election, and with respect to all of these issues, it had been clear that there were certain winners and certain losers, there wouldn't have been any litigation. And even if there hadn't been clear that there were certain winners and certain losers, there may not have been any litigation anyway. In fact, if you look at the Articles of Incorporation, it specifically says that no cumulative voting is permitted. So in some respects, this declaratory judgment action sought not to clarify ambiguity, but to restate something that was already clear in the document. So I agree with you, to the extent this is what you're saying, that it should be a requirement. And if not pending litigation, something really, really close, and certainly not something like in this case. And my time is up, so unless anybody has any further questions, I did not get to the amendment issue, but we raised that in our brief, and we'll rely on that.
All right, thank you very much. Rebuttal?
Thank you. Counsel made three points that I'd like to address. One, that not all the candidates and all the members were named as defendants in the case. People who were sued were the ones who raised the controversy under stare decisis. If once this result was reached in this case, it would be binding. So if the court found three directors to be elected instead of four, that would be binding on everybody. If there's a problem with joinder of parties, the code is clear. That's not grounds for dismissal, 8.01-5. And if somebody out there wanted to join, they were free to intervene. If a party thought that somebody else needed to be added, they were free to move to join them. That never happened. Counsel argued that the General Assembly has determined who has the rights to bring a statute, to bring an action, and that the corporation isn't included in the statute. There's an obvious reason why. Once the corporation holds the election according to the rules the corporation wants to hold it under, it's not going to sue itself. The election will have been held using the corporation's rules. So the only people who can be aggrieved after the election are members or directors. That's why the corporation is not mentioned in the statute. That statute only addresses post-election, not pre-election. And that statute clearly is not exclusive because this court has issued a declaratory judgment. So, in the context of a director's election in a non-stock corporation. So, the argument that that statute is the be-all and end-all is just not correct.
Is there any procedural advantage in your deck action that would shoot across the bow of any rule that would be applicable to the post-election statutory remedy? Do you get any advantage out of this, the fencing point?
No, we don't get any advantage other than we get the question decided before the election so that people don't show up at the meeting and have chaos and have controversy and have acrimony, and we get to avoid this period, however long it's going to be months, we know that, where the election has been held and there's a challenge to who the directors are. And the corporation is sitting there saying, well, who are the directors? The people who deal with the corporation are saying, are you the director? Are you the director? That's what we sought to avoid. It's simple. Let's just get it. Let's learn the rules before we actually have the election. It was as simple as that. And I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.